This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Fatima al-Zahra's lofty position, the 3rd of February, 2021. Regarding Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, even if we adopt an ordinary worldly outlook, perceptive, mystic and spiritual eyes might see other things, of course, we see that the great personality was the Holy Prophet's cherished daughter. She married Ali ibn Abi Talib and had to endure many hardships as he was constantly engaged in the arena of jihad. Then she faced the difficulty of raising four of the most unique children that history has ever seen. Later, she witnessed the loss of her first dear one after the Holy Prophet's demise, Mohsin, her son, and ultimately, she herself was martyred a few months after the Holy Prophet. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la Her 18-year life was full of important events. She was the manifestation of the loftiest human and Islamic concepts about women. She would pay attention to these concepts. Her lesson was about these matters. Some Islamic concepts are particular to a group of people. Concepts such as motherhood, wifehood, being the lady of the house and raising children. Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, God's greetings be upon her, was the epitome of all these concepts. In the area of raising children and of cooperating with her husband, and in areas which involve common duties for men and women, areas such as serving God, which is a great responsibility, Fatima al-Zahra's status was an extraordinarily important and impressive status. Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, greetings be upon him, says, On Friday evening, my mother was awake until dawn praying. Whenever I listened, I heard that she was praying for others. In the morning I said, Mother, you were praying for others, but you did not pray for yourself. She answered, Son, first others, then us. In Surah Hal Ata, Surah Al-Insan, there is an ayah which says, We feed you for the sake of Allah alone. I consider this a lesson for the Islamic Ummah, the Islamic community in the Islamic Republic, a lesson about the sincerity of one's intentions.
Gave me hope, oh. the limelight.
Biden is continuing former President Donald Trump's policy of misusing Title 42 in violation of U.S. treaty obligations. The Title 42 program stems from a misapplication of an obscure public health law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article titled, Biden's expulsion of Haitian migrants is racist, illegal, and Trumpian. Stay tuned for more. Notwithstanding President Joe Biden's promise to pursue a more humane immigration policy than his predecessor, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, has been illegally expelling Haitian migrants, with the Border Patrol cracking whips and herding them like cattle. When U.S. authorities put them on a plane to Haiti, they chained them like animals, hands, feet, and waist. And once they arrived, they unchained them so journalists wouldn't see them, one Haitian man told John Oliver on Last Week Tonight. When confronted about his administration's use of horse reins as whips to menace black migrants at the southern U.S. border, Biden said it was horrible to see people treated like they did, horses nearly running them over and people being strapped. It's outrageous. Biden's denial is reminiscent of that of Barack Obama, who reacted to the 6,700-page report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that documented a widespread program of U.S. torture by saying that torture is contrary to who we are. But like torture, vicious beatings of black people have been sanctioned by the state throughout U.S. history. The images of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and Department of Homeland Security, DHS, agents on horseback whipping and assaulting Haitian refugees blatantly display the clear historical relationship between slavery and modern immigration policy, policing, and carceral state, the National Lawyers Guild said in a statement. The Biden administration has expelled more than 4,600 Haitian migrants from the United States since September 19, conducting 43 flights from Del Rio, Texas to Haiti, which is still reeling from its recent devastating earthquake, flooding from a tropical storm, and a presidential assassination. Most of the people in Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince have no access to drinking water, electricity, or garbage collection. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, call on states to refrain from expelling Haitians without a proper assessment of their individual protection needs and urge them to uphold fundamental human rights. In their statement, they cited de-escalation of violence and insecurity in Haiti, noting that at least 19,000 people were internally displaced in Port-au-Prince during the summer of 2021. In addition, more than 20% of girls and boys have been victims of sexual violence, and nearly 24% of the population, over half of them children, live below the extreme poverty level of $1.23 per day. Nearly 46% of the population, about 4.4 million people, face acute food insecurity, and 1.2 million are at emergency levels, with 3.2 million people at crisis levels. The four organizations estimated that 217,000 Haitian children suffer from moderate to severe acute malnutrition. Expelling Haitian migrants to face these horrific conditions is not only cruel, it is also racist and illegal. The whipping of Haitians by mounted border patrol agents was spectacularly racist, but the use of Title 42 to expel asylum seekers is equally racist and illegal and much more damaging. Attorney Brian Kankanen, a board member at the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, told Truth Out. Indeed, on September 23rd, Daniel Foote, U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, handed in his resignation to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, stating he will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees from the U.S.-Mexico border. Foote called the U.S. policy toward Haiti deeply flawed. Biden is continuing former President Donald Trump's policy of misusing Title 42 in violation of U.S. treaty obligations. The Title 42 program stems from a misapplication of an obscure public health law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944. The act was designed to grant quarantine authority to health officials to expel any persons, including U.S. citizens who arrive from a foreign country. Title 42 was never intended to distinguish between non-citizens who could or could not be removed or expelled from the United States, according to Human Rights Watch. The plaintiffs asserted that the Biden administration's use of Title 42 to deport migrants violates the Administrative Procedure Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act, and the Public Health Services Act. In granting the injunction, Judge Sullivan found that the plaintiffs were likely to prevail on the merits of their claim that the administration's use of Title 42, which has never been applied in the immigration context, is illegal. The judge agreed with the plaintiffs' contention that nothing in Section 265 or Title 42 more generally purports to authorize any deportations, much less deportations in violation of statutory procedures and humanitarian protections, including the right to seek asylum. Judge Sullivan also concluded that plaintiffs would suffer irreparable harm if an injunction were not granted, because they would be sent to their home countries, which are among the most dangerous in the world due to gang, gender, family membership, and other identity-based violence. Finally, Judge Sullivan determined that a preliminary injunction would not harm the government, and it would promote public health to quickly process, quarantine, and regulate people who arrived at the border. He accepted the plaintiff's claim that the public interest requires the U.S. to refrain from wrongfully sending people to countries where they are likely to face substantial harm. But on September 30th, three-judge panel of D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals paused Judge Sullivan's injunction while it reviews Biden's appeal. As Lee Glaren, who filed a lawsuit on behalf of the ACLU, told CBS News, this is just the first step in appellate litigation. Nothing stops the Biden administration from immediately repealing this horrific Trump-era policy, Glaren said, adding, if the administration is making the political calculation that if it acts inhumanely now, it can act more humanely later, that calculation is misguided and of little solace to the families that are being sent to Haiti or brutalized in Mexico right now. The Title 42 policy violates the Refugee Convention, which grants non-citizens the right to asylum if they can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution due to race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion if they are sent back to their home countries. The Biden administration's use of Title 42 also violates the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, which the U.S. has ratified. The that treaty contains a non-refoulement provision. It forbids sending an individual to a country where there is a substantial likelihood he or she would be subject to torture. UNHCR has confirmed repeatedly during the pandemic that expelling asylum seekers and migrants at the border without an individualized determination of the need to protect them violates the non-refoulement provisions of international law. The UNHCR Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Triggs, stated, "The right to seek asylum is a fundamental right. The COVID-19 pandemic provides no exception."
We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Spotlight. China flew 150 planes over the Taiwanese air defense identification zone. Taiwan regards this as irresponsible and provocative action, while Beijing blames Washington for steering the situation and pushing Taiwan towards segregation. China regards Taiwan as a province and has pledged to take it by force if necessary. It considers President Tsai's government to be separatist. Now, this while Taiwan stresses it's committed to safeguarding its democracy.
Tensions between China and Taiwan have once again escalated after Taipei reported that 148 Chinese fighter jets flied over the island's air defense zone since Friday. That was a day Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic of China with a military parade. Taiwanese government officials said they have to be on alert for China's, quote, military activities, while Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, said the island would do what it took to defend itself. This is China regards a self-ruled island, a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. However, Taiwan says it's an independent country and seeks help from the West, especially the United States, to boost its defense. Currently, the U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. On Monday, China once again lashed out at the U.S. for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warship to the Taiwan Strait. The Foreign Ministry described Washington's actions as provocative and irresponsible, and urged it to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. Some experts believe the U.S. is hatching plot to further push Taiwan into secession from China.
The U.S. is trying to push the envelope as far as possible, trying all kinds of tactics and measures to push Taiwan forward as if it was a separate country without declaring its former status as a separate country.
The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. Last week, London sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait for the first time since 2008. That, despite China's constant warning to the US and its allies over such moves. For years, the US and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. But ties between Beijing and Washington deteriorated sharply under former President Donald Trump. China had hoped for an improved relation under Trump's successor. But since taking office, Joe Biden has maintained pressure on China, showing no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies. Biden is even seeking new alliances to counter China's rising influence in the region and beyond.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and today we're discussing the China-Taiwan problem. Let's see who is joining me in this episode. We'll have Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, joining us out of Detroit. And from the Executive Intelligence Review, William Joins is joining us from Leesburg. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, Saeed Khan, the Taiwanese president, has warned of what he is calling catastrophic consequences if the island falls to China. What consequences is he talking about?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. President Tsai Ing-wen, Xi, wrote an article in the Foreign Affairs, which is the Journal for the Council on Foreign Relations, in which she warned about catastrophic consequences for the region. I would suspect that this is a bit of hyperbolic language for two reasons. Number one, China is not reckless in the way that it asserts itself, and it is already the dominant force within the Pacific Rim. Number two, I think it's important also to recognize that many of China's neighbors have acknowledged China's power and influence in the region and have signed on to what is known as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So they are now bound in a relationship that is economic with China, knowing full well, again, the power dynamics that are at foot. So if China were to then go ahead and assert itself in any stronger way with Taiwan, which I don't think it will, then it's really difficult to see what exactly those kinds of catastrophic consequences might be.
Okay, now, William, China is accusing Washington of, you know, being the provocateur and warning against backing the Taiwanese independence. China says that engaging in Taiwan independence is a dead end, and China will take all the steps to what it calls firmly smash any such bid. How serious is China?
Well, it's very serious. Look, China has made a number of commitments. One is that they would not move to a violent reunification of Taiwan with the mainland. I think they adhere to that, but at the same time they said they would not accept Taiwan independence. So to the extent that there is a relationship between the mainland and Taiwan, which does not include moves toward independence, the relationship should go on very well, as it did for many, many years. But since the Trump administration initiated attacks against China, initially on trade, but then beefed it up with the enhancement of the Asia, so-called Indo-Pacific Alliance, it has sent a message to China that the United States and its allies are intent on building a ring around China, containing China. And part of that, of course, has been moves first on the part of the Trump administration and also continued diplomatically by the Biden administration, high-level visits, which previously were really unprecedented since the United States recognized and had diplomatic relationships with the People's Republic of China. And secondly, an indication that they are going to move closer diplomatically as well as militarily in working with Taiwan. And that's all sending a signal that the United States is reneging on its one China policy and ultimately wants to capture China, capture Taiwan as a base for possible attacks against China, and that's unacceptable. So what China is doing with these military forays is really sending a very clear message to President Tsai, who has been playing along with this and who is intent on this independence move, as well as to the United States, which is backing her in that respect, that if they move further in trying to separate Taiwan from the mainland and reneging on the One China policy, then China probably most likely would react militarily. But barring that, they will not. And I think the ball is really in the court of the Biden administration at this point.
I see. Now, Saigon, we also have Taiwan warning that if democracy and the way of life, I'm quoting the president, I believe, if democracy and way of life are threatened, they'll do whatever it takes to defend themselves. Does this mean a war is looming?
Well, I think they're certainly going to try to transmit that as being the threat. The problem, though, is that whether Taiwan is really going to have much support from the international community, much of which doesn't even recognize it as being a sovereign state of its own. Mm-hmm. It has many challenges when it comes to who really wants to confront China in the event that Taiwan wants to defend itself, particularly on grounds of democracy. I think we find throughout the history of the last 72 years, since the Chinese Civil War and the Kuomintang established themselves on the island of Formosa, or Taiwan, as was said before in the report, as China perceives it to be a renegade province. The idea is that there hasn't really been much of a constitution for Western countries to confront China. And this is at a time when China wasn't nearly as powerful as it is now. So it's quite doubtful that the rest of the world is really going to come to Taiwan's aid and defense. It doesn't seem as though it's going to be the proverbial hill upon which the rest of the world wants to die. And the second thing is that Western democracies have done a fairly poor job of defending other democracies. If they see some significant self-interest for themselves, using it as a proxy in a way that doesn't have significant blowback upon itself, then we could see that perhaps there's some way of doing that. But in this call to defend democracy and to use military intervention in any kind of direct way, again, I think is perhaps wishful thinking on the part of Taipei right now.
Okay. Now, William, there are some analysts who argue that Taiwan is hoping to provide deterrence to China by building strong international ties and investment in defense capabilities, including arms purchases through the U.S. Is this the right course it's taken?
Well, this is the way things have developed because of the, on the one hand, because of the Shanghai Communique, but also because of the Taiwan Relations Act, where those who were opposed to creating a diplomatic relations with China tried to put the brakes on it to some extent by passing legislation which assured that Taiwan would have the means for defending itself if it were attacked. And that has been the case ever since the 1979, or even from the Shanghai Communique Agreement. And that has occurred. There are always complaints from China as it occurs, because every year there is some kind of incremental increase in that. But that will not cause a war. That is not the real problem here. The real problem here is the attempt to maneuver, to use Taiwan as a tool of getting at China, and they're playing on the defense. Tsai Ing-wen really is not telling the truth when she says democracy is threatened. She got elected. She got elected in a democratic election. China did not interfere in that. China is not interfering in the internal affairs of Taiwan with regard to the way the Taiwan system works. And the one country, two systems assures that Taiwan will maintain its own system. So that's a false argument. What she's doing now is she's appealing as a so-called victim to try and get the support she felt Taiwan would need if there were a military conflict. The problem is that Taiwan is like a hand grenade in the region. If the Western forces want to try and push for independence, Taiwan will be the first country to go under as a result of that. And it won't just be a regional issue. I think it could lead to a global conflict. I believe that both parties want to stop that, but they are moving, both the U.S. And China also are moving in a direction where a confrontation can very well occur, even though it is not totally intended by the parties. But the real problem here is that we have left the agreements that were made between the U.S. and China in 1979 with the One China policy and really kind of a hands-off Taiwan with regard to independence. That's the problem. And if that continues in that direction and you have a more aggressive policy to get make Taiwan independent, then I think there will be a military conflict in the region.
Now, Said Khan, let's now bring in the United States. Why should the U.S. try different ways to push Taiwan to announce independence from China?
Well, I think we see a very garbled American foreign policy toward Taiwan. And in fact, one could argue that this has been the case really since 1979 at the very least. The fact that the U.S. was so quick, if you will, to switch over from formally recognizing Taiwan as the legitimate China to switching over to the People's Republic of China demonstrates a certain mercurial, a certain petulant nature to the United States whenever it comes to opportunity. And this, of course, has a ripple effect because that was also the case at the United Nations. Now, the United Nations doesn't recognize Taiwan. It recognizes that as a de facto independent country. It meets only 5 of the 8 criteria that the United Nations sets for what would be regarded as a sovereign independent country. So there really is no international consensus regarding Taiwan. However, the United States has thrown up quite a few different conventions, if you will, in order to maintain not only this kind of purgatory status for Taiwan, but also a kind of dependency that Taipei has toward Washington for both economic cooperation as well as for military needs. China has been rather tolerant in the past several decades in allowing the United States to meddle into what otherwise would be seen as a national matter with a renegade province, allowing Taiwan, for example, to purchase F-16s. And then, as was just said, allowing for full and free democratic elections within Taiwan to occur unfettered. America's latest big mistake was with the Trump administration pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, of course, was an agreement intended to then contain Chinese expansion economically and its dominance within the Indo-Pacific Rim. Similar to, of course, what was at least one of the secondary objectives of the Obama administration when it came to the Iran nuclear deal, trying to prevent Tehran from moving closer to Beijing. As you know, the Trump administration pulled the United States out of both the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
In that amount of time, Beijing has only increased its dominance in the region and globally. As a result of this, the United States is trying a bunch of what seem to be hapless efforts to try to contain China. The AUKUS relationship with Australia and the UK ended up having quite a bit of embarrassment because it offended one of their own allies, France, over nothing more than a defense purchase deal of submarines. This is going to be one of the big dilemmas that Taiwan has as it is getting these mixed signals from Washington as to what to do. Washington is not going to go ahead and either formally recognize Taiwan's independence, nor is it really going to allow for Taiwan to put the United States into the position of obligation if Taipei tries to overextend itself by making a declaration of independence. I'm sure that that will fall on several deaf ears to the detriment of Taipei.
Okay. Now, William, as you know, a few countries recognize Taiwan, and also Said Khan mentioned that, but the U.S. has a law that requires it to provide Taiwan with the means necessary to defend itself. What's the deal?
Well, there was a compromise because those who were defending, look, Taiwan was created, the island of Taiwan was created by the United States, which refused to recognize the victor in the Chinese Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So that when Chiang Kai-shek ended up there, the United States said, we're just not gonna recognize this country of then 500 million people. We will recognize this island kingdom with Chiang Kai-shek as the military governor. And that's why you had this phenomenon of Taiwan, which was a part of China, which was returned to China from Japan after World War II, after the Japanese had won it in their defeating China in 1895, so that they have certain legitimate rights to call this a part of their territory, and they do mm-hmm. that. However, with regard to this legislation, this is simply a means of assuring those who were opposed to the diplomatic ties with China that Taiwan would be protected. Now, there's a certain limit to what is a defensive weapon and what is an aggressive weapon, and that's something that that has to be taken into consideration too. Mm-hmm. China is always upset about any incremental increase of weaponry in Taiwan because this weaponry does increase the danger of a military conflict that they really wish to avoid. But the other issue about Taiwan that you must understand, that if Taiwan became independent, formally or informally, it would be what Douglas MacArthur called the immovable aircraft carrier. And that would be a threat to China. And any military operations by the U.S. on that, of course, would immediately lead to war. But that this is what China fears most, that there is a containment policy coming out of the West, which is trying to strangle their economic and technological development. And it's being continued by the Biden administration. And unless that is changed, I don't see any lessening of the tensions over Taiwan mm-hmm. or over any of the other issues which now are a bone of contention between the United States and China. Like I mentioned, it's in the U.S. court to try and show that they are not aiming at destroying the People's Republic of China.
Now, Saeed Khan, one last question. What's future holding for this China-Taiwan issue? Is détente on the horizon, in your opinion?
I think détente would be an ideal situation. As William just said, there is always this danger of incremental escalation mm-hmm. to a point where then one or both parties feels compelled to act in a way that they had not intended to initially. Mm-hmm. Hopefully cooler heads will prevail. Right now it doesn't seem to be the case with this escalation by the United States to create defense/military conventions, including AUKUS and then also the Quad. Although the Quad is being marketed as a way of economic and diplomatic cooperation, it's really a fairly unveiled and ridiculous idea that this is not, in fact, a threat to China, also militarily. The one respite, of course, is that the other three members of the Quad are perhaps not as fully committed to confront China in the robust way that perhaps the Biden administration is. And even there's mm-hmm. question about whether Washington has its full heart behind that. India has proven to be rather incompetent with its recent issues militarily with China last summer on its border. Mm-hmm. Japan simply has far too much to lose if it is seen as being too robust in its membership in the Quad. Australia is a member of the RCEP. It relies too heavily on China's economic relationship with it, which leaves the United States in many ways having to pull most of the heavy lifting on this. And again, I don't see the prospect of Taiwan being allowed to be, nor does the, Washington want to make Taiwan this floating aircraft carrier, as was so aptly articulated. Mm-hmm. This will lead to, hopefully, an understanding by Washington that it will be at best a stalemate between Beijing and Washington when it comes to economic, political, and military dominance around the world. And that kind of a stalemate is exactly then what leads to détente in superpower politics.
Okay. On that note, we've come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests. We had Director of the Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan in Detroit. And from the Executive Intelligence Review, we had William Jones in Leesburg. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
the limelight.
The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons, says Sasha Bromsky, journalist, in an article titled, UK is embarking on largest military spending hike since Cold War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Late last year, with the pandemic in full brutal swing, Boris Johnson's Conservative government in the UK announced a nearly £17 billion, what was then $21.9 billion increase in military spending. The increase spread over 4 years, represented the largest hike in defense investments since the end of the Cold War. And while it was a tiny fraction of what the US spends annually on defense, made clear Britain's ambition to be seen as a global military superpower once more. In an era of escalating tensions between a US-led NATO and Russia, and during a period in which economic competition between China and the West is increasingly morphing into a high-stakes arms race, Britain's move to ramp up military spending made clear that the UK won't be sitting out these new global struggles. In fact, the UK decision to escalate military investments was based on an evolving military doctrine of constant competition with adversaries that would keep opponents off balance, while hopefully staying just clear of provocations that could lead to war. The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons. In March, the government announced it would raise the cap on the number of warheads the country possessed by a staggering 40%, and that it would no longer make public the number of operational nuclear weapons that it controlled. Critics argued to no avail that this would undermine the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which Britain is a signatory. Folded into the new, more aggressive military posture were changes that went far beyond the nuclear arsenal. Johnson's government unveiled plans for advanced new naval systems, set up a new space command, and committed to large investments in futuristic artificial intelligence. As a part of this new posture in which post-Brexit Britain isolated from its half-century-long relationship to the EU, or what was formerly known as the European Economic Community, and the power brokers on the continent, takes on increasingly confrontational military policing roles globally and regionally. The UK recently sent an aircraft carrier and broader naval strike group into South China Sea. The vessels, part of an international effort ostensibly designed to preserve freedom of navigation in contested international waters, sailed between Singapore and the Philippines, deliberately coming within a few miles of contested islands claimed by China in the region. This follows on the heels of another venture in which the UK sent a Navy strike force into the waters off Crimea, territory annexed by Russia in 2014. One can well make the baseless claim that both Russia and China are taking deeply irresponsible actions on the world stage. Yet, acceptance of that critique is different from acceptance of the desirability of giving Boris Johnson's government carte blanche to launch whatever military adventures it chooses to embark upon. In fact, Johnson's government, seeking to shore up its right-wing populist credentials, seems now to want to reach for military solutions even against recent allies. This spring, in one of the stranger post-Brexit moments, the Brits began scrambling up naval vessels against French and other EU fishers in the English Channel. The vessels were rushed off to the island of Jersey and were apparently aimed at breaking a blockade of the local waters by fishers from the continent. Irate that their long-standing right to fish these waters had now been terminated. In the end, both sides stood down, but the very notion that the UK and France could come to the edge of a naval confrontation over fishing rights, with the British government egged on by a snarling, far-right, flag-worshipping tabloid press, is simply astounding and shows exactly how far Britain has veered off course since the Brexit of 2016 set in motion the years-long process of divorce between the UK and its erstwhile partners within the European Union. French fishing vessels haven't been the only targets of the British military in the seas abutting Britain. For much of the past year, as Johnson's government has ramped up its rhetorical and legal campaigns against asylum seekers, ultra-sophisticated military drones have patrolled British waters, looking for migrants desperately trying to enter the country's waters on rafts. The arms build up, and Britain's growing willingness to needle opponents militarily is, to say the least, disconcerting. Yet, it isn't exactly a development out of the blue. For while Britain has, for most of its modern history, steered clear of maintaining large standing armies during peacetime, it hasn't hesitated to use its naval assets to secure global influence. In fact, in many ways, the UK's new doctrine of constant competition and ongoing military assertiveness is a souped-up version of a mid-19th century imperial doctrine, gunboat diplomacy, perfected by statesmen such as Lord Palmerston as a way to realize British ambitions around the world without actually triggering war with the other behemoth on the global stage. Palmerston was a master of the art of military populism. He routinely sent gunboats to potential flashpoints while talking about the military muscle flexing as simply being a defense of British values of liberty, democracy, and freedom. The press and much of the British public relished these shows of force, and for many years, Palmerston bestrode the halls of Westminster, first as Foreign Secretary and then as Prime Minister. He relied on Britain's raw power to impose his views, but, as importantly, he relied on bluster, in the sense that he was just gung-ho enough, just trigger-happy enough, to follow through on his threats, to convince opponents that ceding to Britain would serve their interest better than forcing an actual fight. Today, Johnson is reimagining British diplomacy in a similar way. His government pledged to cut international aid from 0.7% of the gross national income to 0.5%, and recently won a parliamentary vote on the issue. despite former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May joining with a group of rebel members of parliament to vote against Johnson's plan. Yet, even as his government slashes overseas aid in a cruel effort to balance a budget-falling stimulus measures designed to counter the economic impact of the pandemic, it increases military spending. Britain is now the only G7 country cutting rather than increasing its international aid commitments. It is, at the same time, spending more on its military than any other G7 member, apart from the United States, making it the fifth highest military spender on the planet. In 2020, Germany spent 1.4% of its GDP on its military, and France itself, in the middle of a significant military build-up, spent 2.1%. Britain, by contrast, spent 2.2%. This combination of withdrawal from non-military international obligations and high-profile military spending speaks volumes for the priorities of post-Brexit Britain. Moreover, it speaks volumes about the values underpinning Johnson's particularly noxious brand of right-wing nationalistic populism.